Yeah, Michael, this is going to be easy because basically they'll all queue up to ask questions and I just aim them at you.
Okay.
So if you want to ask a question, please, would you raise your hand? It would be nice for us if you could tell us who you are, but you don't have to. So can we take some questions to Michael Ignatieff? Because if you don't start soon, I might start and never stop. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we don't have microphones on the floor, so can
I'll
you
try and speak?
Talk real loud.
My name is David Denby. I teach in DCU on the north side of the city. This may or may not be the Chomsky line that you referred to, but there is a line analysis going back to Central America which says in American discourse, democratic means pro-American. What I noticed, it seems to me the only time you talked about economics in your talk is referring to the cost of the Iraqi war. And I want to ask you about the determining or non-determining influence of American economic interest globally.
Well, I think I heard two questions there. One of them relates to democracy and whether, when Americans use the word democracy promotion, they mean the promotion of regimes favorable to American interests only. There's simply no doubt on the democracy promotion side that this is a very real policy dilemma. I mean, if you see it from the American point of view, and you take a country, two countries like Pakistan and Egypt, Pakistan absolutely pivotal to the war on terror, run by an extremely authoritarian and soft authoritarian like Musharraf. The American dilemma is, do you promote democracy at the risk of bringing Islam to power? Not just any Islam, but a radical, madrasa-fueled, hate-filled Islam to power. Do you, ditto in Egypt, go from the devil you know, Mubarak, to the devil you definitely don't know, which is the Muslim Brotherhood? These are actual dilemmas, because who cares in the end whether it's in the interest of the Americans, but if you're a human rights person and you want to promote democracy in both places, you may end up riding the tiger and ending up inside the tiger. It's an actual problem. I mean, I teach my students clearly what the answer to this. I mean, if we believe in democracy, we believe in democracy, period. And let the chips fall where they may. One of the instructive lessons in relation to democracy is the Algerian election of 1990, where the French attempted to frustrate a democratic outcome, and we had a grotesque and awful civil war. 87,000 people died. For a long time, Algeria was the most dangerous place in the world. And we ought to come out of that with one very clear lesson. You believe in democracy, you abide by democratic outcomes, even if it brings people to power who are violently anti-American. Better that than sticking with illegitimate authoritarians who are trying to keep the kettle from boiling over. So that's the democracy piece. On American international economic power, again, there is no doubt that there is raw political power backs raw economic power. The United States behaves in that way, like any large power. What strikes me, again, it's not an attempt to excuse, you made the reference to Latin America. Every Latin American student I teach, and I teach lots of them, comes to the Kennedy School with a very, very neuralgic relation to the Americans for really deep and good historical reasons. You can't be a Salvadorian or someone from the Dominican Republic or from Venezuela or from Mexico without having a sense that you had to forge your national independence and your national survival in opposition to American power, going back to the United Fruit Company. I mean, all that's clear. But it's also important to see the ways in which American economic power now faces a world in which I get on the plane to come to Dublin today, and what do I read on the front page of the Financial Times? The biggest plane maker in the world is Airbus, not Boeing, right? That is, there are massive redistributions of economic power going on all the time. In 25, 30 years, who knows that American corporations will have the same dominance that they have now? We're working in a world in which a lot of the American domestic debate is precisely worried about the rising power of China, the sucking sound of jobs going out of the American economy, outsourcing to other countries. So, again, I'm taking another shot at Chomsky, but there is a kind of vision of the stovepipe capitalist. I'm not saying you're there. The Yankee dollar dominating the world, which is appropriate to the period of international economic history between 1945 and the late 50s, early 60s, but seems to me ludicrously out of sync with what's actually happening in 2001, where, you know, I'm sorry to go on. My other answers will be more concise, but, you know, the ugly face of, you know, capitalism in the French Valley, where I've just spent 3 weeks, was Kerry, an Irish company, buying up every single fruit-making company in the area. Big Kerry signs everywhere. And half of them said, les Américains. Les Américains arrivent. I kept your secret.
Michael, can we go back to democracy and get away from Kerry for a moment? Chile, Nicaragua, where was the great American dream of democracy there, undermining other people's democracy? And the way they embraced states like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. So how does that fit with your notion of this almost evangelical need to export American democracy?
Well, the evangelical rhetoric is in flagrant contradiction with state interest. And time and again, the United States has found itself, when choosing between evangelical high-mindedness and low state interest, chooses low state interest. That is, topples Allende's government, subverts democratically elected governments, supports terrible ruling families like the Saudis. But the interesting thing, and again, people think I believe everything that George Bush tells me, but I really don't. But what is terribly interesting is to, and it pays rereading, the speech that the president gave to the National Endowment of Democracy in late 2002, in which the president of the United States, this president, the most unpopular president Europe has ever seen, said, if there is one mistake that the United States has made in the Middle East since 1945, it has been being on the wrong side of democracy and freedom in this part of the world. Now, then there's the question of whether he believes it. Then there's the question of whether he knows what he said. Then there's the question of what policy might follow, right? I mean, I'm not as naive as I sound, right? But that is a revolutionary statement for an American president to make. That is to acknowledge that we're on the wrong side of a civil war in the Arab world, and it's been catastrophic for our national interest. We've backed the Saudis, and what have the Saudis done for us? They've turned the place into a gas station and exported a really odious version of a great religion around the whole world, and ended up with, you know, can you imagine what it was like to be an American president and get the first sit rep after 9/11 discovered 16 of the 19 hijackers are Saudis? You've pumped money in this country for 40 years, and what have you got at it? You've got the biggest mass casualty attack since Pearl Harbor. Now, if that doesn't make the United States wake up and reconceive the relationship between democracy promotion and national interest, I don't know what does. Now, nominally, that is what's happening, but it's very difficult.
But he says that, and then he goes and he invades Iraq and sets it all on the table.
Yes.
Well, but let me take. Okay, if we're going to go there, look, and this is the most bitter debate in human rights, and there's no. Let's not. I don't expect charming words are going to convince you, but if we're talking about democracy, I went to Iraq in '92. I spent 6 weeks in northern Iraq among the Kurds. The Kurds were protected by the air umbrella of the United States and Great Britain. And under that umbrella, they began to develop free institutions. We forget that. That was an intervention in 1991 that, in some ways, was one of the most successful human rights interventions using military power we've ever had. On the basis of that experience in 1992, I thought, because I went to Halabja, I saw what Saddam had done in Halabja, I saw what he'd done to the widows of Barzan, I saw what he'd done to countless Kurdish friends of mine, I thought this regime simply had to go. Now, move forward to 2003, you know, there was a kind of crucial moment which divided the human rights community down the middle, or not down the middle, I mean, divided it 80-20, that is, I was on the 20%. The moment when millions of Europeans took to the streets throughout Europe to protest against the war. There were many people in that march across Europe who were as deep and better human rights defenders than I am. But the consequence of that march succeeding in changing public policy would have been to leave Saddam Hussein in power. And if you had been to northern Iraq, as I had done in 1992, you thought, let's swallow deeply, that is not a march, I want to succeed. And having marched all my life, was the first time I thought, this is a march I can't attend. Because the consequences, irrespective of the intentions, and there were many people in the march who hated Saddam as much, if not more than I did, the consequence of the march, had it persuaded Blair to change his mind, would have left Saddam Hussein and his delightful sons in power. And we'd now not be talking about the terrible situation we've got, which is as terrible as everybody says it is. We'd be talking about the perpetuation of a truly odious regime. On those grounds, I thought, you know, and there was one other important moment. The night the bombing started in March, this is March 2003, I was sitting in a public event with an Iraqi intellectual. And he said to me, this is the only chance I will ever have to live in a free country. Right? I mean, that's what it was all about for this guy. And for millions of Iraqis, let me add.
So,
well, now, this is complicated. I never believed, and I never argued, that the human rights arguments in themselves were sufficient to justify the use of military force. Because if you do that, then it's a warrant for essentially going everywhere and doing everything. My case for the war, and the case made by many people, was binary. That is to say, the human rights conduct of the regime was a crucial basis upon which to evaluate its external dangerousness. And here, let me make, say, this is important stuff. Amnesty came out with a statement the day after Bush gave his speech at the United Nations saying, not in the name of human rights. That is, criticizing the Bush administration for referring to the human rights abuses committed by the Saddam Hussein regime in justification by President Bush of his proposal for military action. And that, it seems to me, was a mistake by Amnesty with respect to an organization I revere. It's a mistake because if you don't use human rights to evaluate the external dangerousness of a regime, what have we learned in 50 years? The domestic internal treatment of a population by its leadership is an infallible test of whether it is dangerous. That's why the human rights conduct of the regime is relevant, irrespective of the intentions of those who are about to intervene.
Yeah, but my case, you don't think George Bush was right to invade?
On the basis of the information I had at the time, yes, but that's why I'm making the point. The binary, the case for war was binary. One piece of the case has fallen apart. So had I known what I know now, namely that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, I could not, logically with what I just said to you, authorize the use of force. You had to have the two cases together.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Well, I come, as you know, from a perfect country. I come from Canada, which is in every respect blameless. Its treatment of its minorities is without fault. Its inclusion of all populations has been an example to the world. And Ireland is similarly a perfect country. So because we are from perfect countries, it allows us to freely criticize all other countries. Look, the United States has everything you say it has. I mean, why deny it? It has, just on the point about incarceration, one of the largest incarceration rates per capita in the world. And it has substantial and unconscionable degrees of prejudice and exclusion. It also has 40 million people without health insurance. It's no part of my brief to say that the United States is without fault.
It's no.
Well, but with all due respect to you, tough. That is to say, my job is not to defend the United States. My job is to explain a pattern of behavior, and I'm not explaining it with reference to the fact that what you have to explain is it's a great. What you have to understand is that it's a great democracy. What I said was something different, subtly but importantly different. Its doubts about international law derive from a particular idea of popular sovereignty. The question is not whether it is true to that version of popular sovereignty, and you're saying it's not true, and it betrays that promise. Fine. That's not the point I'm making. My point is that the argument from popular sovereignty is this substantive basis of its opposition to international law. And unless you understand that, you can't understand why it's so difficult. I mean, that's the point. The point is not a defense of the United States, but an attempt to understand why it argues the way it argues, which is a different kind of point.
Okay.
If Turkey secures accession to the European Union, you will have a frontier on the Tigris. That is, the European frontier will be on the edge of Iraq. And you are within Iranian missile range. You will be in the range of Syrian counterfire. You've got a problem. You are tied into the success of the American project in Iraq, whether you like it or not. And everything you say about force levels is entirely right. I mean, it is jaw-droppingly astonishing what the United States has tried to do on the cheap. And they've learned a terrible lesson. Whether they will be evacuated from the roof of the Green Zone as they were in Vietnam remains to be seen. The only thing that's very, very important, and I keep saying this, is don't give up on the Iraqis. It's very important not to give up on the Iraqis. There are 5 million Kurds who know exactly what living in a free society is, feels, and looks like because they've lived there for 11, 12 years. We don't want them to slide back into the period that they knew in the 70s and 80s. Stop believing that democracy is a kind of strange American notion in these parts, because you really ought to read what Ali Sistani, the religious leader of the Shia, has been saying consistently from the very beginning, which is one man, one vote. He understands what majority rule is. We are not in civil war, very largely because Ali Sistani has kept political control over the Shia South. So things are as bad as you describe, but they could actually be worse. And they're not worse because there are a lot of very courageous, smart Iraqis fighting to save their country. Well, we'll see. We'll see. And it's also democracy. Democracy is not the solution to all problems. That is to say, the elections may, in the medium term, make things worse. But we either believe that these folks ought to have a shot at democracy, or we give up. In terms of the question that you asked about what Europe should do, I mean, the historical decision that Europe made in 1945 was to rebuild its economy and create a welfare state and basic social provision by passing the cost of defense onto the United States. That historic choice made in the 40s and 50s has gone on, and basically the with the limited exception of a country like Britain, you've traded away a lot of military capability, and it means that unfortunately, if you're a human rights defender and you want something done to stop massacre around the world, you have to go to the Pentagon, because nobody else is serious. I feel this very strongly as a Canadian. We've traded for 40 years on an entirely bogus reputation as peacekeepers. We used to be peacekeepers. We used to have capabilities. We gave them away because people wanted hospitals and schools and roads, and God bless them. But the costs are coming in. The costs are that you can't be an international citizen, in my judgment, unless you have robust military capabilities. You can't defend human rights unless you have robust peacekeeping capabilities that you're prepared to spend money on. I am not saying that the only way to defend and promote human rights is the point of a gun. I'm emphatically not saying that. But at some point, you may have to. Ask yourself what the poor, starving, and abused people of Darfur need. They need security as much as they need food. And how do you provide security? You provide it with people with guns. That's how the world works. And European countries, Canada, lots of countries, have traded away. And we're now in their ludicrous situation that the only way you can go for a strategic lift, for intelligence, for rapid reaction, is the United States. This is a disaster. And the challenge to European liberal audiences, and I say it all the time, is if you want a fairer, more balanced, more multilateral world, it costs money. And what everybody would prefer is a cheap shot at the United States and actually stumping up. I mean, it's disgusting in my own country. I love my country, Canada. But they would rather bitch about their rich neighbor to the south than actually pay the note. The pay the bill to be an international system citizen is not something that they want to do. What they want to do is the cheap option, which is to complain about the Americans. And I complain about the Americans as much as anybody. I do not want to live in a world where every time someone's massacred, the only person I can go to is a Pentagon general. That's my idea of a bad world, right? But the alternative, a good world, is a world where you can go to the Irish and say, we need, 2,500 troops. We need them there tomorrow. People are being massacred and chopped into little bits. Get down there, and the Irish can say, we're here.
No, we'd say we're neutral. We'd say,
well, America remains the largest single contributor to the United Nations, and it is a difficult member of the United Nations. And there, as I said in the talk, there's constant cheap political capital to be made attacking the UN, and we've seen that recently with attacks on Kofi Annan. But, let's not be pious about the UN. The UN is also part of the problem, not part of the solution. The Security Council is a victors club created in 1945. I mean, explain to the Brazilians, explain to the Indians why a country with 55 million people, France, or 56 million people, Great Britain, has a veto when 1 billion Indians aren't at the table. I mean, we can't go on like this. We need to reform. The panel on high-level threats has proposed a reform agenda. This is a crucial moment for the UN. But, again, don't make the United States the only problem. The people who will go into the last trench to resist UN reform are the French and the British. I mean, the smart thing to do is for them both to give up their veto, give up their seat and create a European seat. So God help us, we'd have an Irish permanent, representative on the Security Council. Great idea, it seems to me. You'd rotate the seat through. That's one way to reform the UN. The other way to reform the UN is to, there are lots of aspects of the UN that simply may be unreformable, and that's because of the endemic corruption of the national personnel system. I mean, it's a very, very corrupt institution. Does God's work, fine. And it has, it also has, and you see this with the World Food Program, and you see it in the reaction to the tsunami, it has amazing logistical and organizational capacities are absolutely vital for the world. The good news here, the good news, is that the tsunami and all complex humanitarian emergencies make it perfectly clear if the UN didn't exist, you'd have to invent it immediately to coordinate, to mobilize, to legitimize, etc. But the institution, the critical problem is a viable reform of the Security Council that enlarges it and changes the basis of membership so it reflects the world of the 21st century. You should read Cass Sunstein's book. Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago. The relevance to this is that he starts the book with Roosevelt's, unbelievable speech to the 1944 Democratic Convention, which is the great speech about economic and social rights being we need a second Bill of Rights. We need a second Bill of Rights that will free the country from want, create rights to employment, rights to basic social security. An absolutely astounding vision of rights entitlement that he put on the table in 44 and was unable to deliver. Sunstein's argument is that through the 50s and early 60s, the United States Supreme Court and the federal court system were slowly, inchoately, proceeding to constitutionalize social and economic rights, rights to welfare, rights to housing, for example, and that and that's through the Warren Court. The arrival of the Nixon presidency in 68, the conservative counter-revolution, which begins in 68, marks the ebb tide of the constitutionalization of social and economic rights in the United States, and it's all been backwards ever since, with one significant proviso, which is federalism. The blue states have been quietly constitutionalizing a lot of social welfare entitlements. State of New York, for example, in relation to housing, other states. You've got to look at the state constitutions and how they work as well, because it's not the idea that the United States is, civil and political, actively, viscerally hostile to social and economic rights is not true. First, because of the Roosevelt inheritance. Second, because state constitutions and state welfare practices differ substantially. There's simply nothing to talk about in the comparison between Massachusetts and Alabama, for one thing. So, where's it going in the international sphere? I'm very, very struck by the ways in which the indivisibility of civil and political and social and economic rights seems just true. That's received an enormous fillip intellectually from the work of Amartya Sen, as you know. And when you teach this stuff, you can't, everybody does it, but it's true. You don't have famines in countries that are democracies, where there is voice. One of the things about the Sen argument is it revivifies the civil and political arguments, because it says voice, the capacity of the oppressed to scream, to shout, to transmit political risk upwards, is crucial to keeping them from dying, right? And that's what we mean by invisibility. We mean something very, very specific, and Sen's work is the place where the linkages are made most analytically clear, and it informs all good human rights teaching.